I'm delighted to introduce today's keynote speaker. Brandon Busteed is Executive Director of Gallup Education, where he integrates Gallup's research and science on selection, strengths, engagement, and well-being to improve student success, teacher effectiveness, and educational outcomes. His mission is to create a national movement to measure the educational outcomes that matter most, connect education to jobs and job creation, and promote a paradigm shift from knowledge mastery to emotional engagement in education. Earlier this year, he garnered international attention for his Bill of Rights for All Students, which is rooted in Gallup's findings. Everyone in the world wants a good job, and no one ever became successful by trying to improve their weaknesses. Please help me in welcoming Brandon Busteed.
Good afternoon. Earlier this summer, I actually had a chance to see the movie Argo, and I was only about 2.5 years old when the Iranian hostage crisis went down, so I obviously don't remember any of it, but it dawned on me as I was flying in this morning that this is now my chance to formally thank Canada for getting us out of that pickle. So thank you, Canada. In any event, some of you may know the name Gallup because of our polling work. George Gallup, who started the organization in the 1930s, is one of the more famous people in the world because of the work that we've done with our research, and was world-renowned as one of the best teachers, actually. So I'm certainly going to talk about some of the insights that we've garnered from our polling work. But the way I want you to think about Gallup today is that we're essentially sitting on top of the world's largest research platform. So every night in America, we interview a representative sample of Americans. We have the World Poll, which is now statistically sampling 98% of the world's population every year, which is an amazing feat. Representative sampling frames in every country, save a couple around the world. We also run what's called the Gallup Student Poll, which is a poll of 5th through 12th graders in the United States. About 500,000 participated last year. And we've also done a lot of work on assessing the best teachers. So we've now had more than 2 million teachers go through an assessment tool that we designed trying to get at the talents of the best teachers. So we obviously have a lot of information and a lot of research to share. And so what I'm going to try to do today is synthesize it a bit and hopefully leave you with some powerful ideas as it relates to that research. Two of the core areas that we've studied the most are engagement and well-being. Gallup has studied workplace engagement, for example, among 24 million people around the world. We get hired by Fortune 500 companies, governments, nonprofit organizations to measure what it looks like to have a good job, essentially. And with well-being, we have been doing this now around the world where we have tried to get to the essence of what it means to have a life well-lived. So I'm going to talk to you about that through those two powerful scientific lenses. What does a good job look like, and what does a good life look like? So obviously, as we think about where we are in the world of education right now, it's in a total state of upheaval, you could argue, in most countries, right? I think about it mostly through the lens of the United States, but all around the world, everybody's talking about education. Everybody's concerned about it. It's literally the number one priority on everyone's agenda, and rightfully so. There's all kinds of forces coming down around it, from technological shifts to global competition, rising cost, by the way, in a lot of places where it's become more and more expensive to get a degree or an education in general. So there's certainly a lot to talk about, but I'm actually going to start with something real simple, which was a crystallized insight that we got from polling work. So we don't usually ask open-ended questions, right? But we ask Americans one night to think about the best teacher they ever had. So I'll ask all of you right now to do the same thing. Think about the best teacher you ever had. Our prompt was to put that person's name in your head. So do that now. My best teacher ever was Alma Blunt. And then what we asked, open-ended, was, what was it that that teacher did that made them your best teacher? Now, I can probably read your minds, if we're any good at our research, because there was one word that people used most to describe their best teacher. Any idea what that was? Close? Other ideas? Maybe Canada is different. No. You've said a lot of very close words. The word that Americans used most was care, that they cared. Now, I want you to think about that very carefully, right? If you think about that being your best teacher, I want to ask, how are we measuring caring in schools right now? We're measuring a lot of stuff. I would submit to you that we're not measuring one of the most fundamental aspects of this. So I want to come back to that, but let me dive into what I think are our two biggest problems right now. The first is actually our obsession with the problem. I would argue that we are looking at schools and teachers and kids through a deficit-based lens. Most of our system is set up around trying to figure out what they don't know, what they're not good at, why they're so ineffective, right? And this deficit-based lens, I would argue, is killing us. I would also submit that the measures we think of as ultimate outcomes are not ultimate outcomes. At best, they're intermediate measures. So the things you see listed here are not things that I suggest we throw out. We should not throw out grades and marks. We should not throw out test scores, right? Or graduation rates. They all matter to some degree. But if we think that's the ultimate end, we're sorely missing the opportunity to think about what is the ultimate outcome of an education. And most of us, if you go about trying to answer that question, would not say it ends at simply showing that you have obtained a degree or that you had a good grade or mark. What we've learned from our Gallup student poll in the U.S. is that engagement in school actually goes down every single year students are in school. In elementary school, engagement is 76% of students. In middle school, it drops to 61%. By high school, it's at 44%. And I'm going to show you some workplace engagement data that shows you that this slide continues into the workplace. Here's the simple point. If we were getting this right, engagement ought to be going up every year in school, not down. So there's something at a national level, there's something I would argue at a world level that we are missing out on here. Here's another interesting one. As we think about all the benefits of technology, this is a good one. The rate of knowledge in the world is expanding exponentially right now. Most of us are aware of that, right? In terms of if you search something on Google and the number of pages that come up, it's just been expanding exponentially. At the same time that the cost of knowledge is trending towards free. Now, I want to distinguish something. I didn't say degree. The cost of a degree is skyrocketing. Okay, it's actually gone up 248% in the United States in the last 18 years, which is 2 times our healthcare tab in that same time frame. Now, many of you in Canada know that the healthcare tab in the U.S. is actually on the verge of bankrupting our country, right? So think about this. College tuition has gone up 2x healthcare in the last 18 years. So the cost of a degree has skyrocketed, but the cost of knowledge is trending towards zero. Khan Academy, Coursera, edX. By the way, before these massive open online courses, you could take every single course at MIT online for free. You couldn't get the degree from MIT, but you could take every single course for free at MIT. Here's the simple point that I think this means for us, that our kids are no longer going to compete ever again on what they know. They're going to compete on how they synthesize that knowledge, but they're not going to compete simply on what they know. In the end, we don't like the results. In the United States, at least, we found that about 50% of our college and university graduates are in jobs that don't require a college degree. That's not to say that they all have terrible jobs, but they're in jobs that didn't require a degree. We also know that as we look at workplace engagement in the U.S., it's not nearly where it should be. And this was a killer finding that we just put out in June in our National State of the American Workplace report. We actually found that when it was cut by educational attainment, our college graduates were the least engaged in their jobs. Now, I want to come back to a couple reasons behind this, but the expectation, of course, everyone, if you had asked everyone to predict who's more engaged in their job, someone with a college degree or without, almost everybody would say, college degree, of course, because that's our expectation of what college and university does for us. It turns out it's not the case. And our researchers initially theorized that it was because, well, maybe college graduates have higher expectations of the workplace that go unmet, right? Well, why then, getting more college, does it bump back up? If you have a postgraduate degree, engagement bumps up slightly. We did this down at an item level, and we found that the big difference between college grads and everybody else was this, that they were much less likely to say that at work they have the chance to do what they do best at every day. Think about that for a minute. And I'm going to come back to what I think some of the conclusions are around it. So here we are in terms of the measures that most of us are paying attention to, right? On the left-hand side are what I call inputs. This, by the way, these are large drivers of our U.S. News and World Report rankings. What was the selectivity of the university? What were the SAT scores of the students getting admitted? What were their high school GPA, right? Large driver of how we rank universities. We're not ranking universities based on the learning gains of students. We're not measuring Harvard graduates. We're measuring the incoming class at Harvard. So we actually know very little about the learning gains that take place at Harvard. Our assumption is that they're great because it's the number one rated university, according to the reports. Although I think Princeton just nipped them this year, and Princeton's number one. But in any event, on the right are the outputs. And I wish this was a more involved list, but it's not, right? We're looking at things like grade point average. We're looking at standardized test scores. We're looking at what we call in the United States gainful employment. So did you get a job? Doesn't matter what kind. So if I graduate from law school and I get a job as a barista, fine job. But you didn't go to law school to become a barista. But that's a win in gainful employment. That would be chalked up as success. Law school grad gets a job as barista. That's a win in gainful employment. So I don't argue that we get rid of these measures, but I do think we need to greatly de-emphasize them, because I'll hit you with a zinger. Hope, it turns out, is a much stronger predictor of college success than SAT scores, ACT scores, and high school GPA. Now, usually there's someone in the back who says, did you say hope? And I spell out H-O-P-E, hope. Yes, hope. One's ideas and energy for the future. Some of the first questions we get are, well, how can you measure that, right? We'll talk about that in a minute, but it has three constructs: goals for the future, seeing multiple pathways to get there, and agency, believing that you have some power in making it so. You can measure this reliably, and by the way, it's a really strong predictor of what happens in the future. So, here's another one. Most of us in the States are really worked up about how we're doing on PISA scores, right? Because the U.S. is now trailing many, many countries on standardized tests around the world when it comes to reading and math scores. And this is interesting data that I just like to point out. There's other ways of looking at talent dimension and sorting in the world. These are the countries where there's overlapping data between PISA scores and global entrepreneurship measures of entrepreneurial activity in these countries. And it's just interesting to note that there's a negative correlation between standardized test performance and entrepreneurial activity. Now, that's a real zinger when we're all trying to figure out how to boost our economy again, when we know that almost all net new jobs are created from small and medium businesses less than 5 years old. There's a secret word, it's called entrepreneurship, right? So obviously, as we think about the performance of schools, I don't think that we can just be relying on standardized test measures. So I've sort of asked you this question, but it's an important one for all of us to ask at this summit. What truly is the ultimate outcome of an education, right? Is it to get a degree? Or is it perhaps to do something that you love, where you're doing what you're best at every day, or that you have a great life, right? I mean, those are certainly ultimate aims that we can aim for and that we can measure. So let me tell you a little bit about what Gallup knows about this. This was actually one of the original obsessions of George Gallup. He actually wrote a book in the late 1930s called The Life Well Lived. We interviewed people who lived to the age of 95 or older in the US. You wanna know the first killer insight we learned from this? That on average, they retired at age 80. So those of you who are working on retirement plans, you might wanna think about it. If you wanna live to 100, 80 would be a good retirement age, right? But what was also interesting is that they all loved what they did. They talked about what they did in a way where they loved it. And when they retired, they were still doing it. They just weren't getting a paycheck, right? So we've been studying this notion of well-being for decades now, and it really got turbocharged by our work with the World Poll in the last decade, where we've been asking these questions all around the world. We start by asking people how they rate their lives. And we've been interested in what things correlate with people who rate their lives highly. We started, by the way, with some 350 items. We've now boiled it down. At least our researchers would tell you that they can pretty much tell you whether you've got a good life or not by asking 10 questions. So when you can get down to 10 super predictive questions, it starts to give you a real formula for what the economics of human development really are. Because these are consistent, by the way, across all countries, cultures, languages, right? These are truly things that are fundamental. It turns out in the research that we found five key domains that define this, right? Career, well-being, social, financial, physical, and community. And I'll describe what they mean in a little bit, but here's where I want to start. The most important, all of these matter, the most important is career well-being. It's, by the way, not defined by an actual job. It's defined by statements like, I like what I do each day, I do what I'm best at every day. Now, I'm going to come back to that. Here's the first thing I always get. People say well-being. Sounds real soft and fluffy, doesn't it? Right? Like hope. Well, what is that? Can you measure it? And if you can, does it even matter? It turns out well-being is a very hard measure. When it came to looking at countries like Tunisia and Egypt in the years before Arab Spring, GDP in both countries was on the rise. That has been our classic measure of the health of a nation, and if we had been looking just at GDP in both countries, no one would have seen Arab Spring coming. But Gallup's well-being measures in those countries were plummeting in the same time leading up to Arab Spring, and were much better indicators of unrest in that country. So we know that well-being matters at a world level. We also know that it matters at an organizational level. So these are healthcare costs to an organization. If you have an employee who's thriving in all domains of well-being, look at the difference in cost between that person and one who's thriving in no domains. It literally just keeps going down by each domain. So you think about how America can avoid bankruptcy. Our $2.5 trillion healthcare tab can be reduced significantly if we just focused on the well-being of our employees. Career well-being, I mentioned, is defined by a couple of core statements saying, I like what I do each day. Think about the careful, how carefully crafted those words are. This is not what I have fun doing, right? It's I like what I do each day. There's a sense of purpose and passion and mission in that. And I do what I'm best at every day. By the way, not once a week, not once a month, not once a year, every day. If you say five strongly agree to either of those statements, the chances are you're super engaged in your job, and the chances are you have a great life. Because it turns out if you have high career well-being, you're 4.5 times more likely to be thriving overall in your life than someone who doesn't. Social well-being is the depth of relationships in your life, not the number. So think about a lot of young people today who have 2,000 or 3,000 friends on Facebook, right? That's not social well-being, according to Gallup's definition, unless they have a handful of those friends or they've built a very deep, meaningful, lasting relationship. Financial well-being is fairly self-explanatory. It can be defined by items like, have you worried about money in the last 7 days? Physical well-being, of course, pretty much sounds like what it is. But I want to talk about community well-being because I think this is one of the areas where we're getting it wrong in education. The average resume I see of a college graduate right now lists about 17 extracurricular and other activities that they're involved in. The gold standard item in our community well-being elements is the one you see here. In the last 12 months, I've been recognized for contributions made to my community. You don't get to that place unless you have made a lasting, meaningful contribution to something. So I'm not suggesting that we don't encourage students to explore and try things. What I am saying is we do want to get them to a place where they get deeply, meaningfully engaged in something that they stick with for a long period of time. So let me transition a little bit to what we know about what a good job looks like. So Gallup got interested in measuring workplace engagement because we realized that engagement was predictive of key performance indicators like stock price, profit, revenue, etc. Turns out that workplace engagement of employees and the engagement of customers are leading indicators. They predict performance in the future. So if I know an organization's workplace engagement, I have a really good handle on how well it's going to do next year. If I look at a company's stock price, for example, it only tells me about what they've done in the past. It is not a predictor of what they're going to do in the future. So when Gallup thinks about how we measure this, some of the items that come out in the workplace as being very powerful are whether you say you can do what you're best at every day, whether you have someone at work who cares about your development, there's that funny word care showing up again, not just in school, but in the workplace, someone who encourages your development. Here's a funny one. I have a best friend at work. If you answer five, strongly agree to that, you're much more likely to stay in that organization. By the way, if you're a student and you say strongly agree to, I have a best friend at school, you're much more likely to complete school. So it turns out in the U.S. that only about 30% of our workplace, of our 100 million workers, are engaged. Now, engaged is what you would sound it to be, right? These are folks who show up, they don't pay attention to the clock, they love what they do, it doesn't really matter, they're just in flow, right? Those who are not engaged are not necessarily terrible employees, right? They're doing just fine, but they're clocking in and clocking out. They don't really think about work much outside of work. And then you have actively disengaged, and it's kind of a funny name that our researchers gave it, right? Actively disengaged. But if any of you have seen the movie Office Space, you kind of know what I mean by actively disengaged. These are folks who, if the building burned down, they would be cheering in the parking lot, right? That's how miserable they are. And they're not just disengaged themselves, they bring you with them in their misery and disengagement. This is data, actually, that we haven't released. So I'm sharing it here for the first time with you. From our World Poll data from this past year. It turns out that in Canada, fewer workers are actively disengaged than in the U.S., but also fewer are engaged. Only 16% of Canadians, according to our representative poll, are engaged in work. So this is obviously an area to think carefully about. The metrics that lead to this definition of workplace engagement, what is it about our schools and our colleges and our universities that can help drive this, not just thinking about what our workplaces can do around it as well. The reason why engagement's important is because it's predictive of all these things, right? Profit, absenteeism, turnover. These are things that business people care deeply about. They don't naturally care about engagement, but when you show them that engagement is connected to these things, you get everybody's attention. We know, though, that going back to where I said we're going wrong, a deficit-based model focusing on what's wrong with people, what their weaknesses are, it's not real productive. It's better, by the way, than being ignored. So this is data that shows workplace. If you have a manager that ignores you, never gives you any feedback, none whatsoever, just ignores you, the chances that you're engaged are virtually zero. Here's the good news. If you have a manager that harps on your weaknesses all the time and is constantly giving you constructive criticism, that is a huge improvement over being ignored. Engagement jumps up dramatically, as you can see from this slide, but there's still a large chunk that are actively disengaged. But if you have a manager who focuses on your strengths, what you're good at, and tries to get you to a place where you do that every day, the chances that you're actively disengaged are virtually zero. You see the difference here? Think about what this would do if we applied this thinking to schools and young people and their development. I'm not saying that you don't focus on this kind of weakness. They're illiterate. Okay, that's not what I'm saying here, right? We need to make sure that they become literate. So don't take me literally on this weaknesses thing. What I'm talking about is figuring out their unique talent sort in a way that aligns with what they're really good at. And the most successful people in the world put that to work every day. So, a couple of things we've learned about 21st century skills. We did a study on this recently about 4 months ago, and we asked all kinds of questions of young adults in the United States, ages 18 to 35, representative sample. So some were college graduates, some were just high school graduates, some had no degree. And we were interested in what it was they experienced in school that was predictive of their work success. And we looked at all kinds of things, critical thinking, skilled collaboration, teamwork, the use of technology, all these things were part of it. It turns out there were two things in particular that were strongly correlated with work success later in life. That is that if you said in your last year of school that you worked on a long-term project that took more than a few classes to complete, you were two times more likely to be successful in work. If you said that you applied what you were learning to a real-world problem, the same thing. Think about how simple and profound that is, right? Long-term project engagement, applying it to a real-world problem. By the way, we can do this in everything from Spanish to the STEM fields, right? This is not just about building a rocket and shooting it into the sky. Project-based learning, long-term engagement, doing it for things that apply to a real-world problem is an amazing differential. And it turns out also that we saw a correlation for individuals that said that during their last year in school, they had teachers who cared about their problems and knew their hopes and dreams. That's really fluffy sounding stuff, isn't it? It turns out it's not so fluffy. By the way, in the United States at least, high schools are doing a much better job of this than colleges and universities are. You see the differential between those with just a high school degree and a college degree? Huge differential. So, to wrap up, I would suggest that we need to be aiming beyond the measures that we have now, not just looking at grades and graduation, but aiming towards things like career well-being and a good life. We can measure this reliably, and it matters. That if we think about the pathway to that, we've learned some powerful things in Gallup research. Hope, engagement, and well-being, by the way, those three constructs account for as much as a third of the variance of student success. Think about that. Schools aren't measuring those three things. And we've shown that people who focus on their strengths drives hope and engagement, which in turn drives their life ratings and classic measures of student success like grades and graduation. We need to shift from this deficit-based model of focusing on what's wrong with students to what's strong about them. And I think we also need to think about different talent sorts. So it turns out that 45% of the kids in the United States say they plan to start their own business someday. That's almost half of the youth in America. Only 7%, however, have ever had an internship, mentorship, or actually worked in a real business. And I just finished analysis of a survey we did of superintendents in the United States, and only 4% of them felt their district was doing a good job teaching entrepreneurship. This is the future of our economy, right? And if our schools don't figure out how to look at that talent sort amidst all the other things, we're in big trouble. Here's a vision for what measurements could look like in the future, shifting from almost 100% of our evaluation of teachers and students as standardized tests and grades, to keeping that as part of the mix, but also adding some of these behavioral economic measures I've shared, like hope and engagement and well-being, and also thinking about how powerfully real experience, work experience, mentorship, and internships evolve into this. And the model of student engagement, by the way, is not about all kinds of things that we think it is. The number one predictor of engaged students is a real simple answer. It's an engaged teacher. So if we want to fix this, we can't fix it without thinking about the workplace engagement of the teachers and staff in our schools and our universities. And guess what? It's all defined at a building level. You either have a great principal or you don't. That leader sends a lightning bolt of engagement through the teachers and staff, which in turn engages the students. That is the model for how we engage students. And at the end of the day, I think it can be simplified like this. This is obviously a complex issue. And I don't suggest that everything is fixed by this. But if you boil all the research I just shared with you down to this, there's three fundamental things that every student, arguably every human being, should have every day they wake up. First, someone who cares about their development. Second, that they should be discovering or doing what they like to do each day, and that they should be discovering or doing what they're best at every day. If we get back to those fundamentals, everything changes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brandon. You've given us a lot to think about, and I'm sure that many of our summit participants will seek you out to follow up with their questions afterwards.